research that shows how telephone poles are biologically related to heart disease. However, there is research that shows the processes by which protein intake and liver cancer might be biologically and causally related, as you will see in Chapter 3. Knowing the process by which something works in the body means knowing its mechanism of action, and knowing its mechanism of action strengthens the evidence. Another way of saying this is that the two correlated factors are related in a biologically plausible way. If a relationship is biologically plausible, it is considered much more reliable. Meta-analysis. Finally, we should understand the concept of a meta-analysis. A meta-analysis tabulates the combined data from multiple studies and analyzes them as one data set. By accumulating and analyzing a large body of combined data, the result can have considerably more weight. Meta-analysis findings are therefore more substantial than the findings of single research studies, although, as with everything else, there may be exceptions. After obtaining the results from a variety of studies, we can then begin to use these tools and concepts to assess the weight of the evidence. Through this effort, we can begin to understand what is most likely to be true, and we can behave accordingly. Alternative hypotheses no longer seem plausible, and we can be very confident in the result. Absolute proof, in the technical sense, is unattainable and unimportant, but common sense proof, 99% certainty, is attainable and critical. For example, it was through this process of interpreting research that we formed our beliefs regarding smoking and health. Smoking has never been 100% proven to cause lung cancer, but the odds that smoking is unrelated to lung cancer are so astronomically low that the matter has long been considered settled. Chapter 3. Turning Off Cancer. Americans dread cancer more than any other disease. Slowly and painfully being consumed by cancer for months, even years, before passing away, is a terrifying prospect. This is why cancer is perhaps the most feared of the major diseases. So when the media reports a newly found chemical carcinogen, the public takes notice and reacts quickly. Some carcinogens cause outright panic. Such was the case a few years ago with ALAR, a chemical that was routinely sprayed on apples as a growth regulator. Shortly after a report from the Natural Resources Defense Council titled Intolerable Risk, Pesticides in Our Children's Food, the CBS television program 60 Minutes aired a segment on ALAR. In February 1989, a representative of the council said on 60 Minutes that the apple industry chemical was the most potent carcinogen in the food supply. The public reaction was swift. One woman called state police to chase down a school bus to confiscate her child's apple. School systems across the country, in New York, Los Angeles, Atlanta, and Chicago, among others, stopped serving apples and apple products. According to John Rice, former chairman of the U.S. Apple Association, the apple industry took an economic walloping, losing over $250 million. Finally, in response to the public outcry, the production and use of ALAR came to a halt in June of 1989. The ALAR story is not uncommon. Over the past several decades, several chemicals have been identified in the popular press as cancer-causing agents. You may have heard of some. Aminotriazole, herbicide used on cranberry crops, causing the cranberry scare of 1959. DDT, widely known after Rachel Carson's book Silent Spring. Nitrites, a meat preservative and color and flavor enhancer used in hot dogs and bacon. Red dye number 2. Artificial sweeteners, including cyclamates and saccharin. Dioxin, a contaminant of industrial processes and of Agent Orange, a defoliant used during the Vietnam War. Aflatoxin, a fungal toxin found on moldy peanuts and corn. I know these unsavory chemicals quite well. I was a member of the National Academy of Sciences expert panel on saccharin and food safety policy, 1978 to 1979, which was charged with evaluating the potential danger of saccharin at a time when the public was up in arms after the FDA proposed banning the artificial sweetener. I was one of the first scientists to isolate dioxin. I have firsthand knowledge of the MIT lab that did the key work on nitrites, and I spent many years researching and publishing on aflatoxin, one of the most carcinogenic chemicals ever discovered, at least for rats. But while these chemicals are significantly different in their biochemical properties, they all have a similar story with regard to cancer. In each and every case, research has determined that these chemicals may increase cancer rates in experimental animals. The case of nitrites serves as an excellent example. The hot dog missile. If you hazard to call yourself middle-aged or older, when I say nitrites, hot dogs, and cancer, you might rock back in your chair, nod your head, and say, "Oh yeah, I remember something about that." For the younger folks, well, listen up, because history has a funny way of repeating itself. The time, the early 1970s. The scene, the Vietnam War, was beginning to wind down. Richard Nixon was about to be forever linked to Watergate. The energy crisis was about to create lines at gas stations, and nitrite was becoming a headline word. Sodium nitrite, a meat preservative used since the 1920s. It kills bacteria and adds a happy pink color and desirable taste to hot dogs, bacon, and canned meat. In 1970, the journal Nature reported that the nitrite we consume may be reacting in our bodies to form nitrosamines. Nitrosamines, a scary family of chemicals. No fewer than 17 nitrosamines are reasonably anticipated to be human carcinogens by the U.S. National Toxicology Program. Hold on a second. Why are these scary nitrosamines anticipated to be human carcinogens? The short answer. Animal experiments have shown that as chemical exposure increases, incidence of cancer also increases. But that's not adequate. We need a more complete answer. Let's look at one nitrosamine, NSAR, N-nitrososarcosine. In one study, 20 rats were divided into two groups, each exposed to a different level of NSAR. The high-dose rats were given twice the amount that the low-dose rats received. Of rats given the lower level of NSAR, just over 35% of them died from throat cancer. Of rats given the higher levels, 100% died of cancer during the second year of the experiment. How much NSAR did the rats get? Both groups of rats were given an incredible amount. Let me translate the low dose by giving you a little scenario. Let's say you go over to your friend's house to eat every meal. This friend is sick of you and wants to give you throat cancer by exposing you to NSAR. So he gives you the equivalent of the low level given to the rats. You go to his house, and your friend offers you a bologna sandwich that has a whole pound of bologna on it. You eat it. He offers you another, and another, and another. You'll have to eat 270,000 bologna sandwiches before your friend lets you leave. You better like bologna, because your friend is going to have to feed you this way every day for over 30 years. If he does this, you will have had about as much exposure to NSAR per body weight as the rats in the low dose group. Because higher cancer rates were also seen in mice as well as rats, using a variety of methods of exposure, NSAR is reasonably anticipated to be a human carcinogen. Although no human studies were used to make this evaluation, it is likely that a chemical such as this, which consistently causes cancer in both mice and rats, can cause cancer in humans at some level. It is impossible to know, however, what this level of exposure might be, especially because the animal dosages are so astronomical. Nonetheless, animal experiments alone are considered enough to conclude that NSAR is reasonably anticipated to be a human carcinogen. So, in 1970, when an article in the prestigious journal Nature concluded that nitrites help to form nitrosamines in the body, thereby implying that they help to cause cancer, people became alarmed. Here was the official line. Reduction of human exposure to nitrites and certain secondary amines, particularly in foods, may result in a decrease in the incidence of human cancer. Suddenly, nitrites became a potential killer. Because we humans get exposed to nitrites through consumption of processed meat, such as hot dogs and bacon, some products came under fire. Hot dogs were an easy target. Besides containing additives like nitrites, hot dogs can be made out of ground-up lips, snouts, spleens, tongues, throats, and other variety meats. So as the nitrite-nitrosamine issue heated up, hot dogs weren't looking so hot. Ralph Nader had called hot dogs among America's deadliest missiles. Some consumer advocacy groups were calling for a nitrite additive ban, and government officials began a serious review of nitrites' potential health problems. The issue jolted forward again in 1978, when a study at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, found that nitrite increased lymphatic cancer in rats. The study, as reported in a 1979 issue of Science, found that on average, rats fed nitrite got lymphatic cancer 10.2% of the time, while animals not fed nitrite got cancer only 5.4% of the time. This finding was enough to create a public uproar. Fierce debate ensued in the government, industry, and research communities. When the dust settled, expert panels made recommendations, industry cut back on nitrite usage, and the issue fell out of the spotlight. To summarize the story, marginal scientific results can make very big waves in the public when it comes to cancer-causing chemicals. A rise in cancer incidence from 5% to 10% in rats fed large quantities of nitrite caused an explosive controversy. Undoubtedly, millions of dollars were spent following the MIT study to investigate and discuss the findings. And NSAR, a nitrosamine possibly formed from nitrite, was reasonably anticipated to be a human carcinogen, after several animal experiments where exceptionally high levels of chemical were fed to animals for almost half their lifespan. Back to protein. The point isn't that nitrite is safe. It is the mere possibility, however unlikely it may be, that it could cause cancer that alarms the public. But what if researchers produced considerably more impressive scientific results that were far more substantial? What if there was a chemical that experimentally turned on cancer in 100% of the test animals, and its relative absence limited cancer to 0% of the animals? Furthermore, what if this chemical were capable of acting in this way at routine levels of intake and not the extraordinary levels used in the NSAR experiments? Finding such a chemical would be the holy grail of cancer research. The implications for human health would be enormous. One would assume that this chemical would be of considerably more concern than nitrite and ALAR, and even more significant than aflatoxin, a highly ranked carcinogen. This is exactly what I saw in the Indian research paper when I was in the Philippines. The chemical was protein, fed to rats at levels that are well within the range of normal consumption. Protein. These results were more than startling. In the Indian study, when all the rats had been predisposed to get liver cancer after being given aflatoxin, only the animals fed 20% protein got the cancer, while those fed 5% got none. Scientists, myself included, tend to be a skeptical bunch, especially when confronted with eye-popping results. In fact, it is our responsibility as researchers to question and explore such provocative findings. We might suspect that this finding was unique to rats exposed to aflatoxin, and for no other species, including humans. Maybe there were other unknown nutrients that were affecting the data. Maybe my friend, the distinguished MIT professor, was right. Maybe the animal identities in the Indian study got mixed up. The questions begged for answers. To further study this question, I sought and received the two NIH research grants that I mentioned earlier. One was for a human study, the other for an experimental animal study. I did not cry wolf in either application by suggesting that protein might promote cancer. I had everything to lose and nothing to gain by acting like a heretic. Besides, I wasn't convinced that protein actually might be harmful. In the experimental animal study, I proposed to investigate the effect of various factors on aflatoxin metabolism. The human study, mostly focused on aflatoxin's effects on liver cancer in the Philippines, was briefly reviewed in the last chapter and was concluded after 3 years. It was later reconsidered in a much more sophisticated study in China. See Chapter 4. A study of this protein effect on tumor development had to be done extremely well. Anything less would not have convinced anyone, especially my peers, who would review my future request for renewed funding. In hindsight, we must have succeeded. The NIH funding for this study continued for the next 24 years and led to additional funding from other research agencies, the American Cancer Society, the American Institute for Cancer Research, and the Cancer Research Foundation of America. On these experimental animal findings alone, this project gave rise to more than 100 scientific papers published in some of the best journals, many public presentations, and several invitations to participate on expert panels. Animal rights. The rest of this chapter concerns experimental animal research, all of which has included rodents, rats, and mice. I know well that many oppose the use of experimental animals in research. I respect this concern. I respectfully suggest, however, that you consider this. Very likely, I would not be advocating a plant-based diet today if it were not for these animal experiments. The findings and the principles derived from these animal studies greatly contributed to my interpretations of my later work, including the China study, as you will come to see. One obvious question regarding this issue is whether there was an alternative way to get the same information without using experimental animals. To date, I have found none, even after seeking advice from my animal rights colleagues. These experimental animal studies elaborated some very important principles of cancer causation not obtainable in human-based studies. These principles now have enormous potential to benefit all of our fellow creatures, our environment, and ourselves. Three stages of cancer. Cancer proceeds through three stages: initiation, promotion, and progression. To use a rough analogy, the cancer process is similar to planting a lawn. Initiation is when you put the seeds in the soil. Promotion is when the grass starts to grow, and progression is when the grass gets completely out of control, invading the driveway, the shrubbery, and the sidewalk. So what is the process that successfully implants the grass seed in the soil in the first place, that is, initiates cancer-prone cells? Chemicals that do this are called carcinogens. These chemicals are most often the byproducts of industrial processes, although small amounts may be formed in nature, as is the case with aflatoxin. These carcinogens genetically transform or mutate normal cells into cancer-prone cells. A mutation involves permanent alteration of the genes of the cell with damage to its DNA. The entire initiation stage, see chart 3.1, can take place in a very short period of time, even minutes. It is the time required for the chemical carcinogen to be consumed, absorbed into the blood, transported into cells, changed into its active product, bonded to DNA, and passed on to the daughter cells. When the new daughter cells are formed, the process is complete. These daughter cells and all their progeny will forever be genetically damaged, giving rise to the potential for cancer. Except in rare instances, completion of the initiation phase is considered irreversible. After entering our cells, step one, most carcinogens do not themselves initiate the cancer process. They first must be converted to products that are more reactive, steps two and three, with the help of critically important enzymes. These carcinogen products then bind tightly to the cell's DNA to form carcinogen DNA complexes, or adducts, step four. Unless repaired or removed, carcinogen DNA adducts have the potential to create chaos with the genetic workings of the cell. But nature is smart. These adducts can be repaired, and most adducts are repaired fairly quickly, step five. However, if they remain in place while cells are dividing to form new daughter cells, genetic damage occurs, and this new genetic defect, or mutation, is passed on to all new cells formed thereafter. Step 6. At this point in our lawn analogy, the grass seeds have been put in the soil and are ready to germinate. Initiation is complete. The second growth stage is called promotion. Like seeds ready to sprout blades of grass and turn into a green lawn, our newly formed cancer-prone cells are ready to grow and multiply until they become a visibly detectable cancer. This stage occurs over a far longer period of time than initiation, often many years for humans. It is when the newly initiated cluster multiplies and grows into larger and larger masses and a clinically visible tumor is formed. But just like seeds in the soil, the initial cancer cells will not grow and multiply unless the right conditions are met. The seeds in the soil, for example, need a healthy amount of water, sunlight, and other nutrients before they make a full lawn. If any of these factors are denied or are missing, the seeds will not grow. If any of these factors are missing after growth starts, the new seedlings will become dormant while awaiting further supply of the missing factors. This is one of the most profound features of promotion. Promotion is reversible, depending on whether the early cancer growth is given the right conditions in which to grow. This is where certain dietary factors become so important. These dietary factors, called promoters, feed cancer growth. Other dietary factors, called anti-promoters, slow cancer growth. Cancer growth flourishes when there are more promoters than anti-promoters. When anti-promoters prevail, cancer growth slows or stops. It is a push-pull process. The profound importance of this reversibility cannot be overemphasized. The third phase, progression, begins when a bunch of advanced cancer cells progress in their growth until they have done their final damage. It is like the fully grown lawn invading everything around it, the garden, driveway, and sidewalk. Similarly, a developing cancer tumor may wander away from its initial site in the body and invade neighboring or distant tissues. When the cancer takes on these deadly properties, it is considered malignant. When it actually breaks away from its initial home and wanders, it is metastasizing. This final stage of cancer results in death. At the start of our research, the stages of cancer formation were known only in vague outline. But we knew enough about these stages of cancer to be able to structure our research more intelligently. We had no shortage of questions. Could we confirm the findings from India that a low-protein diet represses tumor formation? More importantly, why does protein affect the cancer process? What are the mechanisms? That is, how does protein work? With plenty of questions to be answered, we went about our experimental studies meticulously and in depth to obtain results that would withstand the harshest of scrutiny. Protein and initiation. How does protein intake affect cancer initiation? Our first test was to see whether protein intake affected the enzyme principally responsible for aflatoxin metabolism, the mixed function oxidase, MFO. This enzyme is very complex because it also metabolizes pharmaceuticals and other chemicals, friend or foe, to the body. Paradoxically, this enzyme both detoxifies and activates aflatoxin. It is an extraordinary transformation substance. The enzyme factory. In a simplistic way, the MFO enzyme system can be thought of as a factory within the industrious workings of the cell. Various chemical raw materials are fed into the factory, where all the complex reactions are performed. The raw materials may be disassembled or assembled. After a transforming process, the raw material chemicals are ready to be shipped out of the factory as mostly normal, safe products. But there also may be byproducts of these complex processes that are exceptionally dangerous. Think of the smokestack at a real-life factory. If someone told you to stick your face down a smokestack and breathe deeply for a couple hours, you'd refuse. Within the cell, the dangerous byproducts, if not held in check, are the highly reactive aflatoxin metabolites that go on to attack the cell's DNA and damage its genetic blueprint. At the time we started our research, we hypothesized that the protein we consume alters tumor growth by changing how aflatoxin is detoxified by the enzymes present in the liver. We initially determined whether the amount of protein that we eat could change this enzyme activity. After a series of experiments, see chart 3.2, the answer was clear. Enzyme activity could be easily modified simply by changing the level of protein intake. Decreasing protein intake, like that done in the original research in India, 20% to 5%, not only greatly decreased enzyme activity, but did so very quickly. What does this mean? Decreasing enzyme activity via low protein diets implied that less aflatoxin was being transformed into the dangerous aflatoxin metabolite that had the potential to bind and to mutate the DNA. We decided to test this implication. Did a low-protein diet actually decrease the binding of aflatoxin product to DNA, resulting in fewer adducts? An undergraduate student in my lab, Rachel Preston, did the experiment, see chart 3.3, and showed that the lower the protein intake, the lower the amount of aflatoxin DNA adducts. We now had impressive evidence that low protein intake could markedly decrease enzyme activity and prevent dangerous carcinogen binding to DNA. These were very impressive findings, to be sure. It might even be enough information to explain how consuming less protein leads to less cancer. But we wanted to know more and be doubly assured of this effect, so we continued to look for other explanations. As time passed, we were to learn something really quite remarkable. Almost every time we searched for a way or mechanism by which protein works to produce its effects, we found one. For example, we came to discover that low-protein diets, or their equivalents, reduce tumors by the following mechanisms. Less aflatoxin entered the cell. Cells multiplied more slowly. Multiple changes occurred within the enzyme complex to reduce its activity. The quantity of critical components of the relevant enzymes was reduced. Less aflatoxin DNA adducts were formed. The fact that we found more than one way, mechanism, that low-protein diets work was eye-opening. It added a great deal of weight to the results of the Indian researchers. It also suggested that biological effects, although often described as operating through single reactions, more likely operate through a large number of varied simultaneous reactions, very likely acting in a highly integrated and concerted manner. Could this mean that the body had lots of backup systems in case one was bypassed in some way? As research unfolded in the subsequent years, the truth of this thesis became increasingly evident. From our extensive research, one idea seemed to be clear. lower protein intake dramatically decreased tumor initiation. This finding, even though well substantiated, would be enormously provocative for many people, so much so that few, if any, professionals in this area of science want to talk about it or even acknowledge its existence. Such an observation, that increased consumption of protein was capable of initiating the first stage of cancer, questioned our worship of this nutrient, so it had to be wrong. Protein and promotion. To go back to the lawn analogy, sowing the grass seeds in the soil was the initiation process. We found conclusively, through a number of experiments, that a low-protein diet could decrease, at the time of planting, the number of seeds in our cancerous lawn. That was an incredible finding, but we needed to do more. We wondered, what happens during the promotion stage of cancer, the all-important reversible stage? Would the benefits of low-protein intake achieved during initiation continue through promotion? Practically speaking, it was difficult to study this stage of cancer because of time and money. It is an expensive study that allows rats to live until they develop full tumors. Each such experiment would take more than 2 years, the normal lifetime of rats, and would have cost well over $100,000, even more money today. To answer the many questions that we had, we could not proceed by studying full tumor development. I would still be in the lab 35 years later. This is when we learned of some exciting work just published by others that showed how to measure tiny clusters of cancer-like cells that appear right after initiation is complete. These little microscopic cell clusters were called foci. Foci are precursor clusters of cells that grow into tumors. Although most foci do not become full-blown tumor cells, they are predictive of tumor development. By watching foci develop and measuring how many there are and how big they become, we could learn indirectly how tumors also develop and what effect protein might have. By studying the effects of protein on the promotion of foci instead of tumors, we could avoid spending a lifetime and a few million dollars working in the lab. What we found was truly remarkable. Foci development was almost entirely dependent on how much protein was consumed, regardless of how much aflatoxin was consumed. This was documented in many interesting ways, first done by my graduate students Scott Appleton and George DeKnife. A typical comparison is shown in chart 3.4. After initiation with aflatoxin, foci grew, were promoted, far more with the 20% protein diet than with the 5% protein diet. Up to this point, all of the animals were exposed to the same amount of aflatoxin. But what if the initial aflatoxin exposure is varied? Would protein still have an effect? We investigated this question by giving two groups of rats either a high aflatoxin dose or a low aflatoxin dose, along with a standard baseline diet. Because of this, the two groups of rats were starting the cancer process with different amounts of initiated cancerous seeds. Then, during the promotion phase, we fed a low-protein diet to the high aflatoxin dose groups and a high-protein diet to the low aflatoxin dose group. We wondered whether the animals that start with lots of cancerous seeds are able to overcome their predicament by eating a low-protein diet. Again, the results were remarkable. See chart 3.5. Animals starting with the most cancer initiation, high aflatoxin dose, developed substantially less foci when fed the 5% protein diet. In contrast, animals initiated with a low aflatoxin dose actually produced substantially more foci when subsequently fed the 20% protein diet. A principle was being established. Foci development, initially determined by the amount of the carcinogen exposure, is actually controlled far more by dietary protein consumed during promotion. Protein during promotion trumps the carcinogen, regardless of initial exposure. With this background information, we designed a much more substantial experiment. Here is a step-by-step sequence of experiments carried out by my graduate student, Linda Youngman. All animals were dosed with the same amount of carcinogen, then alternately fed either 5% or 20% dietary protein during the 12-week promotion stage. We divided this 12-week promotion stage into four periods of 3 weeks each. Period 1 represents weeks 1 to 3. Period 2 represents weeks 4 to 6, and so on. When animals were fed the 20% protein diet during periods 1 and 2, 20 to 20, foci continued to enlarge as expected. But when animals were switched to the low-protein diet at the beginning of period 3, 20 to 20 to 5, there was a sharp decrease in foci development. And when animals were subsequently switched back to the 20% protein diet during period 4, 20 to 20 to 5 to 20, foci development was turned on once again. In another experiment, in animals fed 20% dietary protein during period 1, but switched to 5% dietary protein during period 2, 20 to 5, foci development was sharply decreased. But when these animals were returned to 20% dietary protein during period 3, 20 to 5 to 20, we again saw the dramatic power of dietary protein to promote foci development. These several experiments, taken together, were quite profound. Foci growth could be reversed up and down by switching the amount of protein being consumed and at all stages of foci development. These experiments also demonstrated that the body could remember early carcinogen insults, even though they might then lie dormant with low protein intake. That is, exposure to aflatoxin left a genetic imprint that remained dormant with 5% dietary protein until 9 weeks later, when this imprint reawakened to form foci with 20% dietary protein. In simple terms, the body holds a grudge. It suggests that if we are exposed in the past to a carcinogen that initiates a bit of cancer that remains dormant, this cancer can still be reawakened by bad nutrition at a later point in time. These studies showed that cancer development is modified by relatively modest changes in protein consumption. But how much protein is too much or too little? Using rats, we investigated a range of 4 to 24% dietary protein. See chart 3.6. Foci did not develop with up to about 10% dietary protein. Beyond 10%, foci development increased dramatically with increases in dietary protein. The results were later repeated a second time in my laboratory by a visiting professor from Japan, Fumiyuki Horio. The most significant finding of this experiment was this. Foci developed only when the animals met or exceeded the amount of dietary protein, 12%, needed to satisfy their body growth rate. That is, when the animals met and surpassed their requirement for protein, disease onset began. This finding may have considerable relevance for humans, even though these were rat studies. I say this because the protein required for growth in young rats and humans, as well as the protein required to maintain health for adult rats and humans, is remarkably similar. According to the recommended daily allowance, RDA, for protein consumption, we humans should be getting about 10% of our energy from protein. This is considerably more than the actual amount required, about 5 to 6%. But because requirements may vary from individual to individual, 10% dietary protein is recommended to ensure adequate intake for virtually all people. Note the difference between requirement and recommendation. What do most of us routinely consume? Remarkably, it is considerably more than the recommended 10%. The average American consumes 15 to 16% protein, while the government recommends levels as high as 17 to 21%. Does this place us at risk for getting cancer? These animal studies suggest that it does so. not necessarily due only to the specific effects of protein, but also to the displacement of those foods that oppose this protein effect. 10% dietary protein is equivalent to eating about 50 to 60 grams of protein per day, depending on body weight and total calorie intake. The national average of 15 to 16% is about 70 to 100 grams of protein per day, with men at the upper part of the range and women at the lower end. In food terms, there are about 12 grams of protein in 100 calories of spinach, 15 ounces, and 5 grams of protein in 100 calories of raw chickpeas, just over 2 tablespoons. There are about 13 grams of protein in 100 calories of porterhouse steak, just over 1.5 ounces. Later in this chapter, we will show the consequences of our choosing how much and what kind of protein to consume. Yet another research question of ours was whether protein consumption could modify the all-important relationship between aflatoxin dose and foci formation. A chemical is usually not considered a carcinogen unless higher doses yield higher incidences of cancer. For example, as the aflatoxin dose becomes greater, foci and tumor growth should be correspondingly greater. If an increasing response is not observed for a suspect chemical carcinogen, serious doubt arises whether it really is carcinogenic. To investigate this dose-response question, 10 groups of rats were administered increasing doses of aflatoxin, then fed either regular levels, 20%, or low levels, 5 to 10%, of protein during the promotion period. See chart 3.7. In the animals fed the 20% level of protein, foci increased in number and size as expected when the aflatoxin dose was increased. The dose-response relationship was strong and clear. However, in the animals fed 5% protein, the dose-response curve completely disappeared. There was no foci response, even when animals were given the maximum tolerated aflatoxin dose. This was yet another result demonstrating that a low-protein diet could override the cancer-causing effect of a very powerful carcinogen, aflatoxin. Is it possible that chemical carcinogens, in general, do not cause cancer unless the nutritional conditions are right? Is it possible that, for much of our lives, we are being exposed to small amounts of cancer-causing chemicals, but cancer does not occur unless we consume foods that promote and nurture tumor development? Can we control cancer through nutrition? Not all proteins are alike. If you have followed the story so far, you have seen how provocative these findings are. Controlling cancer through nutrition was, and still is, a radical idea. But as if this weren't enough, one more issue would yield explosive information. Did it make any difference what type of protein was used in these experiments? For all of these experiments, we were using casein, which makes up 80 to 85% of cow's milk protein. So the next logical question was whether plant protein, tested in the same way, has the same effect on cancer promotion as casein. The answer is an astonishing no. In these experiments, plant protein did not promote cancer growth, even at the higher levels of intake. An undergraduate pre-medical student doing an honors degree with me, David Schulzinger, did the study. See chart 3.8. Gluten, the protein of wheat, did not produce the same result as casein, even when fed at the same 20% level. We also examined whether soy protein had the same effect as casein on foci development. Rats fed 20% soy protein diets did not form early foci, just like the 20% wheat protein diets. Suddenly, protein, milk protein in this case, wasn't looking so good. We had discovered that low protein intake reduces cancer initiation and works in multiple synchronous ways. As if that weren't enough, we were finding that high protein intake, in excess of the amount needed for growth, promotes cancer after initiation. Like flipping a light switch on and off, we could control cancer promotion merely by changing levels of protein, regardless of initial carcinogen exposure. But the cancer-promoting factor in this case was cow's milk protein. It was difficult enough for my colleagues to accept the idea that protein might help cancer grow, but cow's milk protein? Was I crazy? Additional questions. For those readers who want to know somewhat more, I've included a few questions in Appendix A. The grand finale. Thus far, we had relied on experiments where we measured only the early indicators of tumor development, the early cancer-like foci. Now, it was time to do the big study, the one where we would measure complete tumor formation. We organized a very large study of several hundred rats and examined tumor formation over their lifetimes using several different approaches. The effects of protein feeding on tumor development were nothing less than spectacular. Rats generally live for about 2 years. Thus, the study was 100 weeks in length. All animals that were administered aflatoxin and fed the regular 20% levels of casein either were dead or near death from liver tumors at 100 weeks. All animals administered the same level of aflatoxin, but fed the low 5% protein diet, were alive and active, with sleek hair coats at 100 weeks. This was a virtual 100-0 score, something almost never seen in research and almost identical to the original research in India. In this same experiment, we switched the diets of some rats at either 40 or 60 weeks to again investigate the reversibility of cancer promotion. Animals switched from a high-protein to a low-protein diet had significantly less tumor growth, 35 to 40% less, than animals fed a high-protein diet. Animals switched from a low-protein diet to a high-protein diet halfway through their lifetime started growing tumors again. These findings involving full-blown tumors confirmed our earlier findings using foci. Namely, nutritional manipulation can turn cancer on and off. We also measured early cancer growth, or foci, in these lifetime studies to see if their response to dietary protein was similar to that of subsequent cancer growth. The correspondence between foci growth and tumor growth could not have been more impressive. See chart 3.9a. The development of foci was impressively predictive of later cancer growth. How much more did we need to find out? I would never have dreamed that our results up to this point would be so incredibly consistent, biologically plausible, and statistically significant. We had fully confirmed the original work from India and had done it in exceptional depth. Let there be no doubt, cow's milk protein is an exceptionally potent cancer promoter in rats dosed with aflatoxin. The fact that this promotion effect occurs at dietary protein levels, 10 to 20%, commonly used both in rodents and humans, makes it especially tantalizing and provocative. Other cancers, other carcinogens. Okay, so here's the central question. How does this research apply to human health and human liver cancer in particular? One way to investigate this question is to research other species, other carcinogens, and other organs. If casein's effect on cancer is consistent across these categories, it becomes more likely that humans better take note. So our research became broader in scope to see whether our discoveries would hold up. While our rat studies were underway, studies were published claiming that chronic infection with hepatitis B virus, HBV, was the major risk factor for human liver cancer. It was thought that people who remained chronically infected with HBV had 20 to 40 times the risk of getting liver cancer. Over the years, considerable research had been done on how this virus causes liver cancer. In effect, a piece of the virus gene inserts itself into the genetic material of the mouse liver where it initiates liver cancer. When this process, called transfection, is done experimentally, the animals are considered transgenic. Virtually all of the research done in other laboratories on HBV transgenic mice and there was a lot of it, was done primarily to understand the molecular mechanism by which HBV worked. No attention was given to nutrition and its effect on tumor development. I watched with some amusement for several years how one community of researchers argued for aflatoxin as the key cause of human liver cancer, and another community argued for HBV. No one in either community dared to suggest that nutrition had anything to do with this disease. We wanted to know about the effect of casein on HBV-induced liver cancer in mice. This was a big step. It went beyond aflatoxin as a carcinogen and rats as a species. A brilliant young graduate student from China in my group, Jifan He, initiated studies to answer this question and was later joined by Dr. Zhiqiang Cheng. We needed a colony of these transgenic mice. There were two such breeds of mice, one living in La Jolla, California, the other in Rockville, Maryland. Each strain had a different piece of HBV gene stuck in the genes of their livers, and each was therefore highly prone to liver cancer. I contacted the responsible researchers and inquired about their helping us to establish our own mouse colony. Both research groups asked what we wanted to do, and both were inclined to think that studying the protein effect was foolish. I also sought a research grant to study this question, and it was rejected. The reviewers did not take kindly to the idea of a nutritional effect on a virus-induced cancer, especially of a dietary protein effect. I was beginning to wonder, was I now being too provocative in questioning the mythical health value of protein? The reviews of the grant proposal certainly indicated this possibility. We eventually obtained funding, did the study on both strains of mice, and got essentially the same result as we did with the rats. You can see the results for yourself. The adjoining picture, see chart 3.10, shows what a cross-section of the mouse livers looks like under a microscope. The dark-colored material is indicative of cancer development. Ignore the hole, that's only a cross-section of a vein. There is intense early cancer formation in the 22% casein animals, D, much less in the 14% casein animals, C, and none in the 6% casein animals, B. The remaining picture, A, shows a liver having no virus gene, the control. The adjoining graph, see chart 3.11, shows the expression, activity, of two HBV genes that cause cancer inserted in the mouse liver. Both the picture and the graph show the same thing. The 22% casein diet turned on expression of the viral gene to cause cancer, whereas the 6% casein diet showed almost no such activity. By this time, we had more than enough information to conclude that casein, that sacred protein of cow's milk, dramatically promotes liver cancer in rats dosed with aflatoxin, mice infected with HBV. Not only were these effects substantial, but we also discovered a network of complementary mechanisms that created the effects. Next question. Can we generalize these findings to other cancers and to other carcinogens? At the University of Illinois Medical Center in Chicago, another research group was working with mammary breast cancer in rats. The research showed that increasing the amounts of casein in rats' diets promoted the development of mammary breast cancer. They found that higher casein intake promotes breast cancer in rats dosed with two experimental carcinogens, 7,12-dimethylbenz-A-anthracene, DBMA, and N-nitroso-methylurea, NMU. Operates through a network of reactions that combine to increase cancer, operates through the same female hormone system that operates in humans. Larger implications. An impressively consistent pattern was beginning to emerge. For two different organs, four different carcinogens, and two different species, casein promotes cancer growth while using a highly integrated system of mechanisms. It is a powerful, convincing, and consistent effect. For example, Casein affects the way that cells interact with carcinogens. DNA reacts with carcinogens, and cancerous cells grow. The depth and consistency of these findings strongly suggest that they are relevant for humans for four reasons. First, rats and humans have an almost identical need for protein. Second, protein operates in humans virtually the same way it does in rats. Third, the level of protein intake causing tumor growth is the same level that humans consume. And fourth, in both rodents and humans, the initiation stage is far less important than the promotion stage of cancer. This is because we are very likely dosed with a certain, albeit very small, amount of carcinogens in our everyday lives. But whether they lead to fully developed tumors depends on their promotion or lack thereof. Even though I became convinced that increasing dietary casein promotes cancer, I still had to be wary of generalizing too much. This was an exceptionally provocative finding that drew fierce skepticism and even wanton hostility. But these findings nonetheless were a hint of things to come. I wanted to broaden my evidence still more. Perhaps these findings were a seed that might expose a far greater truth. What effect did other nutrients have on cancer? And how did they interact with different carcinogens and different organs? Might the effects of other nutrients, carcinogens, or organs cancel each other? Or might there be consistency of effect for nutrients within certain types of food? Would promotion continue to be reversible? If so, cancer might be readily controlled, even reversed, simply by decreasing the intakes of the promoting nutrients and/or increasing the intakes of the anti-promoting nutrients. We initiated more studies using several different nutrients, including fish protein, dietary fats, and the antioxidants known as carotenoids. A couple of excellent graduate students of mine, Tom O'Connor and Yuping He, measured the ability of these nutrients to affect liver and pancreatic cancer. The results of these and many other studies showed nutrition to be far more important in controlling cancer promotion than the dose of the initiating carcinogen. The idea that nutrients primarily affect tumor development during promotion was beginning to appear to be a general property of nutrition and cancer relationships. The Journal of the National Cancer Institute, which is the official publication of the U.S. National Cancer Institute, took note of these studies and featured some of our findings on its cover. Furthermore, a pattern was beginning to emerge. Nutrients from animal-based foods increased tumor development, while nutrients from plant-based foods decreased tumor development. In our large lifetime study of rats with aflatoxin-induced tumors, the pattern was consistent. In mice with hepatitis B virus-altered genes, the pattern was consistent. In studies done by another research group with breast cancer and different carcinogens, the pattern was consistent. In studies of pancreatic cancer and other nutrients, the pattern was consistent. In studies on carotenoid antioxidants and cancer initiation, the pattern was consistent. From the first stage of cancer initiation to the second stage of cancer promotion, the pattern was consistent. From one mechanism to another, the pattern was consistent. Since the publication of these research findings in top-flight, peer-reviewed scientific journals during the 1970s, 1980s, and 1990s, then publication of a summary of this evidence in the first edition of this book, I have witnessed the public's reaction to this information. There is no doubt that many people, including well over a million readers, have taken note. Although reactions have varied widely, as expected, it is clear that these reactions have been intensely personal. Some, when reading this chapter, have said, "That's it," and committed themselves to dietary change forevermore. The thought that their most revered nutrient, when consumed in excess, enhanced development of their most feared disease, was enough to alter their eating, no further explanation needed. Others, deeply embedded in cultural dietary practices, also have said, "That's it." But their reactions were to read no further, then go on a tirade questioning why this research was ever done in the first place. Either way, this evidence has touched intensely held beliefs. Still, then as now, I could not ignore the possibility that this evidence still narrows.